So we've looked at the kind of philosophical blueprints of our city, and we've started to look at raising it up and building it in the physical sense of that word, in new ways of doing things, and also in new chemicals, in new physical structures. But the city of the future is not only going to exist in the physical sense. Not even our cities of today exist only in the physical sense. What is the internet exactly? Because many of us live most of our lives inside of it. And can you point to that on a map? Now, augmented and virtual realities are introducing something new. Imagine a world in multiple layers, like an onion, with your physical city, a base or a core in that first layer, and then layer after layer after layer on top of that, comprised of different games, educational facilities, mediums for building, art, construction ARs, or surgical ARs. This is something we touched on in our reality episode back in the first season of Anatomy of Next. In a world of ubiquitous virtual and augmented reality technology, we argued that people are going to start interacting with the physical world through the virtual, and increasingly they'll be living more of their lives this way. So the question worth grappling with now is, how complicated does a world get when you can build on top of it along this new virtual dimension? What are the legal or cultural challenges here? In this episode, we're going to start with an exploration of one of the more practical applications of augmented reality, which is construction, kind of wrapping up our look at how we're going to build our first city. And then we complicate the story and take a peek inside that next totally virtual layer. You saw Ready Player One, right?
Back again so soon? Careful not to lose your shit.
From Founders Fund, I'm Mike Solana, and you're listening to Anatomy of Next, New World.
It's the future of the instruction manual, and everything needs instructions.
Well, the beauty of AR, and someone would say the bane of its existence, is that there's going to be multiple layers of AR experiences.
Any type of AR device can project and educate at the same time.
In our last feature episode, we talked about the shape of our first Martian city. And now I think we've got a kind of interesting bridge between that, and specifically the construction of our first city, and the broader virtual dynamic that's going to be a part of any future human habitat. Just what is it going to look like exactly if people start living most of their lives inside of something that most people today would not consider real? But before the wild and crazy stuff, let's take a look at one of the more practical applications.
And instead of a 4-year or 5-year apprenticeship, maybe it'll only take a year or two with the way a HoloLens or any type of AR device with intelligence can project and educate at the same time when a worker is out on a job site.
Robert Clue is president of Martin Brothers in Southern California, a specialty contractor in high-end commercial and residential work.
We take on a lot of high-risk projects, and we're always looking for shortcuts.
Imagine a contractor on a desert field overlooking a barren construction site, preparing to start the day's work. He or she is not going to be operating the way my dad might have in the early 90s with a huge team from paper blueprints. Robert Clue is an early example of a kind of construction worker to come. Though primarily working with a more traditional approach, Robert's been committed to finding new ways of doing things in an industry that really hasn't been open to change. One of these new ways of doing things. So imagine putting on a headset and watching light up in front of you exactly what you're trying to build. It's a virtual blueprint on top of the real world in front of you. And then piece by piece, you're guided through the construction by experts. Robert's been experimenting with the HoloLens headset with software created by Scope AR. He walked me through what working with this kind of stuff looks like.
What I wanted to see was, I wanted to see how much time it could actually save if I had a HoloLens on and it projected a relatively accurate model, a 1-to-1 scale model. So I put my tools back on after about 20 years, and I built a model based on a piece of software that Scope had provided us and worked with us on. We took something that we'd had on another project. It was a bathroom pod, and it had metal studs, it had a backing component, it had a ceiling component, and we do framing, so we have studs. So what we did is we took one of these models that we had already built in an environment, and we placed it in a room and anchored it on the ground. And all we had was that holographic image. And what we did is we took
When you say you had a holographic image, so I'm imagining you're standing inside of a room, on your head is some kind of AR hardware, and you're seeing a model overlaid onto the room?
Yes, you're seeing a model that's overlaid in a portion of the room, and it's actually on YouTube. It's been out for about a year, year and a half. We did do a GoPro film of it where we actually did it and showed that it can be done. We had a couple of people saying that wasn't possible, but I was really too dumb to know that it wasn't possible, and I did it about a year, year and a half ago. And ever since then, I knew this is where the industry is going.
I wanted to talk to someone who was actually designing this technology, so I reached out to the CEO of Scope AR, which, as we mentioned just before, designed the software Robert was running on his HoloLens.
Everybody screws up IKEA furniture. If you saw it being built in front of you in augmented reality, that would never happen.
Scott Montgomery is the CEO and co-founder of Scope AR. They're using augmented reality to kind of redesign the instruction manual of heavy industry. He and I talked about the nature of construction today, how that's evolving, what it might look like on Mars, and then what are some other applications of this technology?
Back in 2011, I was actually trying to build a game for the Apple TV. When the Apple TV didn't pan out, there was no app store for it. I'm like, oh crap, what do I do with this? And so I started looking at augmented reality. But we had a customer that came to us and said, hey, could we use this for training? And we thought, oh, that's a cool idea. The proof of concept was very successful. And they said, cool, this is awesome. We want to show this at a trade show, a large mining trade show in Las Vegas.
Mining, yeah. Like
copper mining, you know, deep earth, big machines. So we were with this company that manufactured the giant mining trucks where, you know, they're six stories tall. The wheels themselves are two stories tall. And the piece of equipment we were demoing on was this thing called a rock drill, $250,000 piece of equipment that drills rocks. This one guy's story in particular sticks out. He said, this piece of equipment I've been maintaining for my entire career, 35 years. Just now I learned how to do it properly. I've trained hundreds of other guys to do it the wrong way. I've shortened the lifespan of this piece of equipment by about half. So I've probably cost my company like tens of millions of dollars. I need this technology, like sell to me now. And so we thought, oh, wow, that's cool. I think there's a viable business here. This is going to be game changing. That was really kind of the turning point. We decided to get in this full time and do it.
You know, we're at this point in the season where we've built this planet, we've terraformed the planet, we're growing life on this planet, we've cracked that code with genetic engineering and new plant models. And now I want to talk a little more seriously about building our first city. I think a lot of people like to focus when they talk about building the city on Mars on just like the way it looks, and it's going to be really futuristic. They're going to be like domes everywhere and weirdly sparsely populated. You see these parks and futuristic paintings where like no one's really there. They're just giant glass buildings and that's it. But I want to get a little more granular. I want to talk a little less right now about what the city is going to look like and a little more on how we're going to build it. What are people right now getting wrong about the way construction has to happen?
I think the construction industry is an industry that really hasn't changed that much. It's the way we did it 50 years ago. We've added some interesting tools like, you know, lasers and, you know, automated drills and you know, heavy equipment like that, but still fairly manual. You know, we were still using paper blueprints. It's a lot of different groups that don't really speak the same language. You know, a construction site is fairly chaotic. There's a lot of room for improvement. If you look at just in terms of productivity, the manufacturing space has improved something like 10x improvement in the past 50 years. And the construction industry has actually decreased in productivity in the past 50 years. And that's due to increased regulation or strict building codes. You just have to do things, you know, slower. It's rich for opportunity.
We're in luck. There are no regulations so far on Mars. We're kind of in the new Wild West. I want to try and paint a picture of what a construction site looks like on Mars. And I know you're not a Martian geologist or anything like that. So let's just suspend belief for a second and just talk about the actual, like, how many people are there? What are they wearing? As they're building something, what does that look like?
I'm going to imagine there's not a lot of people. We've got a pretty sparse population at this point, and there's not a lot of specialized trades. These guys are probably, you know, just pioneers. They're generalists. They kind of just know how to do a basic set of tasks and don't really have specialized knowledge. So you're going to need a way to transfer that knowledge to this small cohort of new pioneers to be able to build things. And it just so happens that, you know, we have a technology that allows us to aggregate knowledge in a way that has really never been done before up until the past 20 years where we've got computers. And really, it's all about teaching those workers how to execute those instructions as quick as possible. In my world, augmented reality, we really believe that AR is just a new user interface, but it's a much better user interface than we're used to using with computers. So, you know, a keyboard and mouse is really kind of an indirect way to interface with a computer. A mouse is a two-dimensional abstraction where you could use this clumsy device to point at things. We've evolved to work with our hands and our eyes and consume information with our visual cortex, which is extremely powerful. And compartmentalizing the knowledge transfer from a small two-dimensional screen with a small segment of our vision into that frontal cortex is really not taking advantage of all that power. So if you're able to overlay information in a 3D context and guide you through in a much more intuitive way, you can do that knowledge transfer much, much faster.
Let's get back to those few people. It's, you know, we have it's a sparsely populated area. There's a handful of people trying to build a structure with maybe the support of a fleet of semi-autonomous robots. What is the assist you're giving them? How does it feel on their head? Like, what is the hardware piece? And then what is the software piece that you're running on top of that? Like, walk me through the process of building something with your technology.
Kind of how I would envision this would be to have a pair of AR glasses. It's something that was probably, you know, inside the spacesuit. They're probably using it on a day-to-day basis because, you know, by now technology's been evolved to the point where it's usable day-to-day. On their trip over from Earth, they probably use these glasses for maintenance activities on the spacecraft, potentially a communication device. They're communicating with their family this way. Kind of how I would see this is that, you know, they would see blueprints overlaid on top of, you know, this blank empty space.
So they're like walking up to just an empty, sand pit, them and their robots and a bunch of raw material they've built, and just the augmentation of the reality looks like now a structure is on top of that empty space. They can see the structure. They can see now like what the first steps are to building that structure.
Going into a space, just sand right now, and then being able to visualize what a particular structure might look like in that space. You can walk around it in you know, full reality, see that, you know, there's this rock here that needs to get moved. So we should probably account for that. And then just really account for the full space. Maybe there's this berm over there and, you know, the existing structure, the structure we're conceiving to put there won't fit. So maybe we got to choose a new structure or something like that.
So it is like I put on a headset. It's some new generation version of Google Glass that people are actually using. I download your program. Now I'm using your software. I look out on this empty pit and before me sort of blossoms the building that I'm eventually going to build. And I can walk around inside of it, you're saying. I can see spatially like what has to go, what has to, in terms of like rocks or other things, what has to be dug. And then what? Then there's someone on the other side, maybe an expert, telling me what to do.
Could be, or it could be a preset of instructions. So, you know, we've got this blueprint for this building that's been probably manufactured on Earth. They already know how to do this. This is just kind of a secondary representation to teach you how to do this. Now that you've decided where you want to put this thing, I could guide you through how to do it. So you need to lay the foundation of concrete. So, you know, pretty self-explanatory. So let's now say that we've got the concrete laid down. So now how do we build this? Well, so the first step is going to be to lay your studs. So you've got your bottom track that's, you know, going to lay out the foundation for where you want to, you know, place your walls. Then you're going to place a few studs for the, you know, basic support, and then lay the top track. Then you're going to lay your drywall, or I guess before that, you'd do your plumbing and your electrical and all of that. And so this is all laid out using augmented reality and step by step. So, you know, now our worker can see exactly where in space he needs to lay out the bottom track according to this building plan, and then go through each step on how to build this. So fairly intuitive. All you need is a basic set of handy skills to be able to do this. The AR instructions will guide you through how to do it.
My brain is sort of immediately going to all these other applications for this outside of construction. I'm thinking of like surgery as maybe the easiest first step. There have to be other applications that you've thought of. What are they?
Having the most success in manufacturing. We work with large customers like Lockheed Martin and for CPG, it's like Johnson & Johnson and Procter & Gamble. Lockheed, I think, has one of the most compelling use cases we've heard of. They've done some studies on the efficiency that they've seen with manufacturing gains. What they saw was that the time to consume information was decreased by 90 up to 99%.
By information, you mean just instructions?
Yeah. So the way a manufacturing technician would go into building something is they would take these paper instructions that could be on an iPad, but, you know, they're text-based. They've got, you know, two-dimensional renderings of what needs to happen. You know, Lockheed, and I think this is a military term, it's called OODA. So observe, orient, decide, and then act. The OOD, the observe, orient, decide, kind of takes about 50% of any given procedure, and then actually doing the procedure is the other 50%. That entire first half of it is reading the documentation, understanding what you're supposed to do, doing a mental map from that documentation, those diagrams onto the real world, probably getting a second pair of eyes, QA, to come in, verify that what you're about to do is the correct course of action, and then actually going ahead and doing it. That first 50%, they were able to reduce the time by about 99% in certain scenarios, simply because you're taking all this information that is now textual based and just overlaying it in three dimensions. And it's like, oh, okay, I know what I need to do. We're taking it down from hours down to minutes. Extremely efficient.
You can do a lot with this. It sounds like, I mean, anything from maybe a 17-year-old, he just got his car, he takes out his phone because his tire is flat, doesn't know how to change it. And he looks at his tire through his phone and it kind of guides him through the process, to someone in Pasadena working on a rocket ship.
Yep.
So the applications on Mars are pretty much endless.
It's the future of the instruction manual, and everything needs instructions.
But in today's cultural environment, such things are unfortunately and immediately met with scathing criticism from the media. One of the big recurring questions here. But are we potentially putting people out of work? As I alluded to a little earlier in our episode, when I was a kid, my dad was in construction. He worked in drywall. And my family needed that income. Would something like this have hurt us? And criticism of our relentlessly criticizing media aside, I don't know, is there something to this? Is it going to hurt families? Scott and I talked a bit about this, the resistance to the technology broadly, and this labor force issue a little more particularly, because I think that's really the sticky issue. And when it comes to politics, especially in the decade to come, I think this issue is going to be just totally electric.
So we're talking about numbers where, you know, we can improve your efficiency by 30, 40, 50%. All workers here is, so we can do these things, you know, half as fast. Does that mean we're going to half the workforce next year? Organizations are always looking at ways to cut costs. So am I going to have to let go of my friend, or am I going to get let go? There's this psychological barrier, whether or not it's founded or not. There's, you know, a little bit of resistance. There's privacy concerns. You know, I've got this camera on, or I'm filming my procedure. Do I really want my work being filmed so that my boss can see the screw-ups I've made? Like, now I'm able to kind of hide them.
Yep.
One of the benefits of our software is that we have all this ability to track data. So we can track the time per step of a procedure, track, you know, and compare that against workers. We, you know, can see your GPS coordinates. We can see checklists. So, you know, did you turn the power off before doing this? Take a picture of this gasket you just removed. You know, we're just collecting a vast amount of data. Well, there's privacy implications there. Again, you know, if I'm a union worker, and as soon as the foreman goes around the corner, I'm able to slack off right now. It's not the case with this AIR technology. If we're tracking, you know, we're feeding you the steps, you can't go to the next step and get your job done without us tracking the timestamp of that. Now you can't slack off anymore. A whole lot of benefits for organizations, but you know, there's some creepy factor in the workforce that you really have to get over. And so really it's all about education. It's about, you know, you can do your job more efficiently. You can do your job more safely because you're better educated about, you know, the safety implications of what you're about to do. And just know how to do your job better and can avoid accidents. You know, that really needs to be communicated to the worker. Otherwise, they kind of freak out. And nobody likes change either.
Right.
It's just a, you know, a big problem. So,
all right. So first off, it's just way safer. That's not a small thing. In data collected by Business Insider, 3 of the top 10 most dangerous jobs in America were construction related. This sort of software is literally going to save lives. Many, many, many of them. But then this topic also came up with Robert Clue, and he had an interesting take I had not considered. As a guy on the ground actually dealing with construction issues, so not just the guy pontificating about the issue on Twitter, the real problem in construction right now is actually finding enough people to work.
Hopefully what it'll do is we're about to lose a significant portion of our workforce, the baby boomers, and we need to fill that gap and we need to educate the millennials that are coming in a lot quicker. And my feeling is their adaptability to this type of technology will be much faster. And instead of a 4-year or 5-year apprenticeship, maybe it'll only take a year or two with the way a HoloLens or any type of AR device with intelligence can project and educate at the same time when a worker is out on a job site.
Right, so the image of folks using augmented reality in a machining context or in a construction context, in surgery maybe, in repair, begins to hint at the larger, stranger theme of our episode. That layer thing, right? We're creating new layers on top of the world that we can dip into, that are capable of impacting the physical layer or substrate that we live inside of. And then there's this gaming stuff.
We're back now with something that may explain any odd behavior you've seen on the streets recently. The smash hit mobile game app Pokemon Go has only been out for a few days, but it's already got millions following their smartphones to the most random places, and police fear possibly into harm's way.
In July 2016, Pokemon briefly took over the world. The most downloaded mobile game in its first month in history, with over 500 million downloads by September, and the fastest $100 million gross in history, then the fastest $500 million revenue in history. The importance of this single product cannot be understated. It was not just a game. Pokemon Go was a total paradigm shift. I was on a bus 2 days after it came out, and a high school student turned to his friend, like mid-story, and threw his hands up. He said he had to get off at this stop because he could see an Onyx, C, with his own eyes, literally see down the street. Okay, there was suddenly a visual link between the physical world and the virtual world that sort of hung between the two. And everyone in America and then the world knew exactly what you were talking about. And separately from just like the innate coolness of this, it raises all sorts of questions we've never had to deal with before. The obvious one in an American political context, if you build a virtual object on my property, who owns it? Not too long ago, Founders Fund hosted a panel on this very subject.
You're a pioneer in the space, and that comes with certain policy changes, particularly as it pertains to the First Amendment. I think it's actually such a huge issue and that we're not thinking about it as much as we should because we're going to come head to head with it pretty soon. What sort of protections do we have when we augment public spaces? How do we approach this world that employs two-dimensional laws in an increasingly three-dimensional world?
Our partner Cyan Bannister talked to the founders of Niantic and creators of Pokemon Go, John Hankey and Phil Kaslin. They started their chat with a really important court battle that recently took place in Milwaukee County. When Pokemon Go launched, you know, tens of thousands of people started hanging out in public parks that used to be fairly quiet. A few old locals in Milwaukee County got mad, as a few old locals are wont to do. They made some noise and persuaded some politicians to draft a local ordinance that would require all augmented reality mobile app developers to request permission from the town to create virtual objects that just exist, you know, virtually in a public park. This is actually something that Niantic at that size, at that time, could have possibly handled. It would have been really, really hard, really, really detrimental to the business. But they might have been able to do it at scale. They were that successful. But of course, a much smaller company would not, at least not at scale, have been able to keep up with this. As is often the case with unthoughtful regulation, larger players are actually inadvertently assisted by regulation while smaller players are sort of elbowed out. So Candy Labs, a different company from Southern California, sued.
Basically the Milwaukee County versus Candy Lab.
Okay, sure. So this was the Milwaukee County Park Commission basically passed a regulation that said that any augmented reality game would have to apply in advance for a permit before it could be allowed to exist. And they sent us the form, and the permit form was the same form that you would fill out if you were having a 4th of July picnic or something. So you would, you know, specify how many people were coming and all of that, and pay
a fee,
of course.
Per person.
As well.
Not kidding.
But I mean, yeah, that wasn't the thing that was troubling. It was just that, you know, that act of sort of pre-registration with a local authority obviously would be a huge inhibitor if you wanted to have a nationwide or global experience. It would be pretty much impossible if that were, in fact, the rule everywhere. So it was one of those situations that really opened our eyes. It was, the facts of the case were that obviously, you know, Pokemon Go had been very popular in that area. It continues to be very popular, but there were certain parks there where large numbers of people had gathered. There were issues with trash, and there were neighbors that weren't happy that all of these people had come to their quiet neighborhood. There was a particular park in an affluent part of town that had attracted people to the park in numbers that had not been seen before. And so that, from what we heard, that group of local citizens had then complained to the city council, which had then leaned on the park authority to sort of do something about it. And they passed that. Kind of while we were negotiating with them, talking with them, trying to talk them off the cliff of actually going forward with the regulation, another company, Candy Lab, is the name of the company.
What do they do?
They make an like AR poker game or something.
It's an AR poker game, yeah.
Is anybody here with Candy Lab? There is, I guess, a nascent industry trade association, and they worked together to file this brief. It was actually a great brief, and it was about protecting free speech, essentially.
So Candy Lab saved the day.
Yeah, we actually
They asked for an injunction against this, and that ultimately was granted, and the judge kind of cast aspersion on the regulation. There was no like final ruling about it. It was a preliminary ruling, but it was enough that the city backed off, and they've decided not to enforce. And actually, today or yesterday, they announced that they're reimbursing Candy Lab for the legal fees.
I think it's
$85,000.
That's awesome.
Legal fees.
It's great for
them. So
they
did kind of back off from that, but it's kind of a close call. But it's probably a sign of many more discussions like that to come, I think.
Yeah, and I guess that segues well into my next question is, what sort of impacts do you believe that ruling is going to have on our future of location-based AR gaming?
The impact of that ruling? Well, I mean, I hope it's, it definitely went the right direction in terms of the free speech arguments got made, and there was this ruling that suggested that, hey, before you jump in and start regulating things like this, you need to pay attention to what the impact is on speech. So that's a good thing, but there are a lot of jurisdictions in the world, mm-hmm. and the thing with AR is that, you know, it sort of weirdly bleeds the digital and sort of local property and kind of local physical access laws and regulations, which, you know, tend to be made and adjudicated at the local government level. So there's certainly room for lots of different interpretations about how that should work to happen in cities around the world. You know, that's the thing that we're all facing, you know, and I think it's probably something that we will, if you all are involved in, you know, AR and related kind of technologies, it's probably something that frankly is going to be an ongoing discussion, debate, policy, tug of war for the next many years, I think.
I think the key phrase in that, though, was world, right? Like, this was adjudicated in a county in Wisconsin. It doesn't really talk about what happens everywhere else.
Right. Do you feel that in America there are more challenges than, say, in the rest of the world?
Well, there are. I mean, there are legal protections for free speech here in the United States
yep.
that don't exist in most places in the world. So we're probably in much better position to defend it from a free speech point of view here than in other countries. And in addition to the sort of authoritarian types of governments where you really just don't respect free speech at all, you know, Europe's an interesting situation because you have a very aggressive kind of privacy policy there, and there's a new version of that, as I'm sure many of you are aware, coming down the pike. So, you know, that's going to create, I think, a pretty challenging environment as well. That would be my guess, just based on past experience with things like Google Street View in Europe and the kind of policy perspective on that.
For now, in the U.S. at least, AR development remains safe, and developers are still working in the space. That means the kind of layering of the world we talked about a little earlier is going to continue. That also means the world is getting crowded.
Well, the beauty of AR, and someone would say the bane of its existence, is that there's going to be multiple layers of AR experiences. So there'll be the Niantic layer, maybe the Facebook layer, the Snap layer, the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all based on the same exact location. So what are the solutions to sort of address some of these concerns about, you know, people coming to a place en masse, coming to something that technically is just, you know, sort of a row in a database. So like private property owners of physical property, like making rules of conduct, or have you seen anything that you've worked with, like local governments or private property owners to try to figure out how to address these situations? Because eventually it's going to be, you know, looking out 2-3 years from now, there's going to be multiple companies potentially at the scale you're at today.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of the what can you or what should you be able to do at the far extreme as a matter of free speech. We have tried to be accommodating of the realities of what it really means for people to be using an experience like this in the real world and to, you know, just be reasonable about it. So for example, if private business owners say, hey, we don't really want people coming to our private business, we'd rather not be in your game, then we will remove them. If a park says to us, hey, you know, we close the park at 10 p.m., we don't want people trying to come into the city park after hours or trying to scale the fence after we lock the gates to the local zoo or whatever, I mean, that's reasonable to us. And so, you know, we have hours of operation, you know, things that we've added since we launched the game to try to accommodate. So there might be cases where you would have really the right to do something in an extreme case, but I think it's probably better if we save those for the, you know, the place where you really want to, you know, have a strong political opinion about something you want to express, and in other cases try to be reasonable and work with local communities and to try to avoid practical problems like too many people showing up or people showing up in places where they're not wanted, you know. At the same time, you know, there are situations like public parks where you want to give the local community and local citizens an opportunity to express themselves. Like, what do they want to do? Like, there are cases where you have a local park and they reserve part of the park for weddings, and they have certain sections they really don't want people to use mm-hmm. at certain times a day or for certain. Maybe they think it's okay for people to play soccer there, but they don't want people to play Pokemon there or some other AR experience. Just kind of weird interpretations. And so rather than just accepting what some individual local official says without any kind of public hearing or giving the public a chance to sort of weigh in and express what they want, you know, that makes me a little uncomfortable. So, you know, we've adopted this policy of tombstoning a location. So if we, you know, take it down in some sort of public area, we say this was removed at the request of the such and such organization. So at least if people disagree with that decision,
then go do something about it.
They can have a local discussion about that. And, you know, there may be people on both sides of the issue locally, and it should be kind of worked out.
Have you had that happen? Level. Like a town hall discussion of a tombstone Pokestop?
Many, yeah. I mean, in fact, in the Milwaukee case, they had public hearings, and the Go players and the Ingress players showed up en masse to defend the right to play the games in these public parks. And
that's awesome.
So, yeah.
So, my Scott came up with this really awesome analogy. basically, and it you know, it kind of threw me for a bit, but I it's totally similar. But how similar is augmented reality to a Yelp review?
Yeah, it's interesting when you really kind of break down what you're saying there, because there is this sort of kind of semantic confusion about AR in terms of you think about placing an object in a place, and it's very easy to talk about it and think about it in terms of like atoms and physical space because you're trying to simulate that in a sense, and you know, with digital things. So it does start to feel at a gut level to people, and people start using the language about, oh, you put something on my property. As if you really, you know, place some atoms there in a piece of property that they owned, rather than having a row in a database that has latitude and longitude as, you know, one of the attributes and some descriptors of some, you know, visualization that somebody can, you know, perceive through a digital device when they're there, in the same way that they might be able to read a Yelp review or read an unfavorable commentary about how the, you know, city council is run if they, you know, went to City Hall. So. I think it is really dangerous to start trying to regulate this, and it's dangerous when people start talking about it using these physical analogies, because that's not correct, I think, and it would lead to a very restrictive way of thinking about, you know, this whole thing.
Yeah, that's one thing that scares me, is there are a lot of conversations around that, which is, you know, trying to think of it as a physical thing versus, you know, just a row and a database.
And I mean, we kind of were guilty. I mean, we kind of want to suggest to the user that it's real, you know, in the context of the game. You want to see, this virtual character, it's really there. And you want to make it as realistic as possible. And you want to be able to walk around it and have the right lighting and have it cast a shadow. And you, like, we are trying to make it feel as if it's there. But in reality, it's not. And it's only there if a person wants to use the right software to perceive it. And people with different software can see different things. And I kind of think it should be up to an individual to decide what sort of filter they want to put over their perception of the world, you know, not for the world to decide what kind of filter that you can have when you perceive it.
This episode, we've been focusing on the way augmented reality is changing the way we work and reshaping the physical world. But the promise of digital layering and virtuality is bigger than that. VR is going to open up entire new planes of existence. In the Martian context, in its most humble iteration, that means folks aren't really going to be confined to their spaceship on the journey over, or to the probably modest size of their habitats towards the beginning of the colonization process. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, I wanted to look at the crazier, wilder vision for all this stuff. So I went and asked one of my crazier, wilder friends for an interview.
I don't think there's any innate human value in connecting with the people that are physically around you rather than distributed around the world.
Palmer Luckey dropped out of college at 19 to start a virtual reality company called Oculus, which he ultimately sold to Facebook. He since left the company to focus on defense and to start a new venture, Anduril. These days, Palmer spends most of his time on defense technology, and we spent most of our interview talking about it. Material we shared, by the way, a couple weeks back in a side chat. So if you've just been following our feature episodes and skipped ahead, but you're still interested in digging into the reconception of our defense industry a little further, definitely go back and check that out. Also, make sure to check out Founders Fund's panel on defense, the intersection of government and technology, which we shared that week as well. Now, Palmer started his career, famously, in virtual reality. And he also has quite a few thoughts on AR, augmented reality, which is where I did just want to kind of quickly start with my layering theory of the future. Now let's dig a little further into the potential here with an expert. Awesome. Okay, so we're trying to imagine a new city on Mars. And in doing that, it's become sort of impossible not to talk about virtual and augmented realities. I have kind of a weird idea. I haven't seen so much information on this. I want to know what you think about it. It seems like the world is increasingly layered. Like the city of tomorrow is going to have stacks. Like there'll be a physical city and then an augmented layer or a virtual layer, maybe five augmented layers, basically like different parts of the city that you can access, things that you can see, ways that you can interact with the city that you need some kind of, I guess, technological medium to access. I mean, is that real? Like how do you see AR, VR shaping the physical city?
So I think that what you're going to see is, first of all, a lot less decoration. Right now, what you see in a lot of structures is kind of design that will appeal. You see design that will appeal to people. If you can augment everything, or rather, if everyone is definitely going to be augmenting everything anyway, it seems like it would be harder to justify, you know, spending billions of dollars extra on a city just trying to make it look nice. So I think there's a chance you actually see structures fall to a much more, you know, brutalist type of interpretation of what architecture should look like, because why waste the money when you know everyone is going to be augmenting their view of what the structure looks like anyway and giving it new utility, new aesthetics.
This is sort of like what we just saw in the new Blade Runner, where, you know, Ryan Gosling walks into his apartment. It's a stark gray box. He presses like sort of a button or whatever and just changes the entire aesthetic of it in a second. Now it's this Japanese tea house, or then it's like this beautiful 19th century aristocrat's house. And of course, Blade Runner is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a recent favorite of mine.
Have you ever daydreamed and imagined that you were somewhere else?
I do have an active imagination.
Well, we don't have to imagine, we project. We choose to see our environment in any form we wish, whenever we wish. For instance, right now you see us as standing in a hallway, but I see it as a forest. Filled with trees, birds,
sunlight. In 2004's remake of Battlestar Galactica, the Cylons were able to see the world however they wanted to. They also totally murdered the entire human race, but let's just save that topic for another day. In terms of how they lived, essentially immortal and surrounded at all times by beauty, it's not terrible. Palmer took the conversation to Star Trek, though, which I am guessing you're sick of me talking about by now. Certainly my colleagues are.
You know, even looking further back than that, the concept of the holodeck, or, you know, it's not just something that you necessarily go and do as a focused activity. It can be something that is augmenting every part of your life all day long. And I think if it actually gets to that technological point where you can provide a good enough experience, it's almost inevitable that architecture will reflect that.
Palmer and I talked a bit more about AR and the impact this technology is going to have on our concept of reality. But we moved pretty quickly into the stuff he actually spent a good chunk of his professional life building, VR. We talked about the way that technology has changed the nature of human relationships, and will continue to. We talked about the technological hurdles still facing the nascent VR industry. We talked about Oculus adoption, and we rounded our conversation out with a little chat on the facts of the technology versus its fantastical hype. There's a lot of really cool stuff here, so I'm just going to go ahead and share most of it. This portion of the interview runs about 20 minutes.
It's not a one-off thing, and you're going to keep seeing things like Pokemon Go that have similar effects. But I do like remember that at the end of the day, I'm a big VR guy. I think that a lot of this is just going to transition from being a merge between the virtual world and the real world into just being fully synthetic environments. And I think right now there's a big element of people interacting with each other just because of geographic proximity. And I think that virtual reality allows people to be proximate to each other through proximate interests rather than proximate geography. So I think you actually end up in the future with a world where people spend a lot of time digitally with people who have, you know, similar interests, who want to work on similar things that are spread all around the world rather than just connecting with people who happen to be closer to them. And I've had people tell me they think that sounds dystopian, the idea that you would, you know, rather connect with people distributed across the globe rather than the people all around you. But I don't think there's any innate human value in connecting with the people that are physically around you rather than distributed around the world. I think it's really the same thing as long as the technology can bridge the gap. Like concretely, if you have somebody who literally knows nobody in their entire city because nobody in their entire city has any interests that are similar to theirs. Let's say that you're, you know, a super geeky kid who's like me into virtual reality, and nobody in the entire city you're in cares about it. But you connect with all these other people all on the internet over this shared mutual interest. I don't think there's necessarily less value in those connections just because they're distributed with people who are around. And people would say, oh, that's like so sad. Like they're cut off from the world around them. And I'd say, no, they've just found a new world to live inside of.
Right. And of course, I mean, we're already seeing this. Like I was just telling you before this interview started, one of my best friends in the world, I've only met physically twice.
Right.
We talk every day, all day on text. We share articles.
Right.
We call each other. Like we know everything about each other.
And that's even through the limited digital mediums that exist today. Yeah. VR has the potential to not just be as good as real world communication, but to actually be better in many cases than real world communication in terms of being better at being able to share ideas, experience the same thing together. Like that, you can't do that with today's technology.
But I guess my question here would be, this sounds like something that would be very compelling, perfect virtual reality right now. But in the future, aren't we not going to be finding ways to actually bring people together physically who have those common interests? Or is that just not valuable or not gonna happen?
I think it comes down to an economic value and resources question. Like, let's assume that all technology does advance to some massive degree and we're looking at 100 years from now. It could be that it's possible to move people together physically so they can do this. Like, let's say using suborbital flights and beamed energy and all kinds of cool stuff like that. But the question is, why would you do that? You're only going to do it if the experience that you get out of it is significantly better than what you could do in virtual reality. Why would you use lots of resources and lots of time to physically move people together when they could experience basically the same thing without the cost, without the time? The only reason I can imagine that would be the case is for things that could not be done in virtual reality, which would become a much smaller and smaller and smaller set. And then also like the same reason that I think rich people do rich person things, which is often just to show off that they can do it. There's a lot of experiences where you can spend 100 times as much to do something that's 1% better than what you could do otherwise. Like there will still be summits. You'll still have people who get together in person to, enjoy the fact that they're able to have the luxury of being together in person. But I think if you have perfect virtual reality and perfect transportation capability, it's hard to see why you would pick the one that takes a lot more energy and a lot more time and a lot more resources for everybody.
All of this sounds really cool. It also sounds really hard technologically. We're not quite there. I think there is a big difference between talking to like a square boxy looking avatar and being just like physically in the same room as someone.
Sure.
What are the technological hurdles between getting to a kind of virtual reality that you see that you believe would achieve mass adoption for things like we're talking about now, bringing people together in the digital world?
It's just progression on a roadmap that's already well established. Like the technology that we need to do this is not crazy future tech that we don't even know if it's possible. I mean, we know the rendering can be done. You can do photorealistic rendering, not in real time yet, but you can do photorealistic rendering. We know the display technology will get there. We're far away from the physics limits of doing retinal projection that is extremely high resolution. So the technology just needs to keep progressing and getting better and better and better. And it sounds unbelievable to some people, but I mean, look at what games looked like 20 years ago and look at how display technology and how rendering technology has evolved in the last 20 years. We've gone from 8-bit graphics to incredible near photorealistic, high frame rate, stereoscopic 3D virtual reality experiences. So I don't even think this is not hundreds of years in the future. I think it's in the next few decades, you're going to see nearly perfect virtual reality become accessible. And the thing that's going to make virtual reality go mainstream is going to be achieving some kind of quality, maybe not perfect, but something that is approaching perfect. I mean, I talk to people who say that they're not interested in VR, that they're not sure it'll ever take off. I'm like, oh, come on. If you could experience anything, do anything, go anywhere in the world, and it was $99 and the size of a pair of sunglasses, wouldn't you use it? And they're like, oh, well, that's not what VR is. I'm like, well, not today, but it is going to get there. And if you can accept that premise that the technology is going to get there, it's pretty clear that people would be willing to spend money and spend time doing this. I think it's basically inevitable. There's almost no way that it does not come to pass. It's just a matter of time. A lot of people think that the thing that's holding back virtual reality is something like the cost. Like, oh, if it's just too expensive at $400 or $300, it just needs to get even cheaper. And that's just has not been the case throughout history. Like, we're already at the cost level where if it was compelling, people would buy it and use it. The only thing that really matters is engagement. How often do people use it? Like, sales don't matter at all. Engagement is the only thing that matters. And so if you look at it from that perspective, what drives engagement? Is it the cost that they pay up front, or is it the quality of the experience that keeps the person coming back? You don't even have really high engagement from hardcore VR users who are willing to put up with the limitations of the technology today. Like, if they paid half the price to get in, they're not going to use it five times as much. The technology is not at a point where it could become the next smartphone or the next personal computer, but it will get there.
Because the content's not there.
The content's not there, the hardware's not there, and at some point, those will advance enough where the price is almost irrelevant. Like, right now, price is kind of an important factor given the quality we have and given the kind of limited audience that will be interested in that level of quality of content and hardware. But if you imagine you have perfect VR, the cost is just not going to be a significant factor. Like, if it's $1,000 adjusted for inflation or $100 adjusted for inflation, like, that's not the thing that is going to determine if someone does this or not.
VR has been around for, a while now. The Oculus has been around for a few years now. What has the adoption looked like? Have you been excited about it? Have you not been? Is there any concern there at all that people just maybe don't want this?
I think people do want it, but again, they want the Matrix virtual reality glasses right. That are $99. That's what the average person wants. The people who are adopting VR today are people who are interested enough in VR as it exists today to want to use it despite the flaws. And that is a huge group of people. I think it's probably tens of millions of people at least who want to be regularly using VR, even at today's quality level. And it's going to get to hundreds of millions and eventually billions. The thing that people need to remember is that, yes, Oculus has been around for a while, but part of the perception of us being around for a while was because we, from 2012 until 2016, didn't even have a consumer product. Like, we were very much in development. We were shipping development kits to game developers. And that's a process that happens with every single console generation as well. There's, years before it comes out, game developers are working with early hardware. It's just usually a closed off process that very few people have insight into. So it appears that the game, a game console just appears out of thin air on the day that it's announced, and, and then everyone finds out about it. But if you look at it that way, we launched the Rift barely 2 years ago, and that was really kind of starting the first generation of consumer virtual reality, at least in the modern day. And if you look at the adoption of virtual reality headsets compared to the adoption of, let's say, the iPod at the same point in its lifespan, it's actually doing far, far better in terms of user adoption. I think people need to keep this in perspective. It's a new technology. It is expensive. It is limited, but it's already doing better than something that was hailed as revolutionary and world-changing from basically the moment it started. I mean, when the iPod came out, nobody was saying, oh, are you worried about the adoption of the iPod? They're like, holy shit, Apple's selling millions of music players in a single year. And VR is doing way better than that. I mean, Samsung's Gear VR has sold well into the teens of millions already as a single device. And, I said earlier that engagement is all that matters, not sales. But if you're going to measure it by sales and compare it to other devices, VR is actually moving a lot faster than a lot of people expected. There are, of course, analysts who made these absurd predictions. Like, you had analysts predicting that first generation VR headsets from individual companies were going to outsell the iPhone in its first 2 years of sales. It's like, the hype was not on the side of the people making the VR headsets or right. Even the investors. The hype was on the sides of these analysts whose job it is to figure out what the next big thing is. That's where the biggest hype was coming. You didn't see any of these companies coming out and saying, hey, we're going to be selling many, many, many millions of all of our headsets in the very first year. Even though in some cases that's actually what happened. You had them saying, we know it's a long road. We know that it's going to be 5 to 10 years before we see a financial return on this. So the people who are actually in the industry, I think, had a much more sane view than the people outside of it. And some of the backlash you're seeing where you have journalists writing stories like, is VR dead? Is this the end for VR? They're just looking to write things that get clicks. They're not in the industry. And they weren't part of the process that led to the industry. They weren't part of any of the business discussions that predicted how these things were going to go. They're just trying to find whatever the hot thing is. And you know what? They don't necessarily hate VR. If VR starts selling better than an analyst predicts, they'll be back and saying, oh, looks like VR is doing better than everyone expected. They'll write whatever is going to get them the most attention.
Right. I wonder where that hype came from for VR, it seems like we didn't have a story. Maybe there was no version of the iPod in Star Trek that was super.
No, exciting. It wasn't sci-fi technology.
It wasn't.
And time machines, flying cars, mm-hmm. virtual reality, yeah. augmented reality. Yep. Cyborgs, like these guns. Are all, those are all staples.
Right.
Digital music players were not a staple.
Not one of them. So you didn't have to worry. You didn't have to compete against the fantasy realm.
Correct.
Jobs could just build it. So it's the gulf between the expectations and reality that is actually the shortfall. Not like the technology itself is not failing.
That's sort of the case. I think that a lot of the gulf there is not as big as you'd think. People in the 80s and the 90s. Who were most excited about VR were usually consumers who had seen movies and kind of had this Hollywood idea of what it was going to be like. They were the ones who were most excited about VR. The ones who actually tried it, at least the consumers who actually tried it, were often the ones who kind of realized it had a long way to go and were less excited about it. But that has actually flipped in recent years. I think the people who are most excited about VR now are the ones who have used it and used it extensively. The people who haven't used it are the ones who have largely written it off as this crazy hype thing. So I think that people who are engrossed in science fiction are maybe the biggest victims where you know, they're suffering from the gulf you're talking about, where they understand just how good it can be because they've been presented with this idea for so many years and they are sad that it is not yet there. But for the average person who isn't steeped in science fiction, VR is something that is much more interesting to them once they have had a chance to try it.
So you're standing on the edge of a field of genetically modified wheat beneath a red-blue sky, and you're overlooking this kind of huge, empty pit of rust and rock and sand. You don't really want to be a farmer anymore, but you do have a cool idea for a factory complex you've been toying with. You tap your glasses, pull up a set of blueprints with a quick voice command, and a building rises up all around you, from its frame to its hull to a projection of a bunch of NPCs or a non-player characters standing in for your structure's future Martian inhabitants. All right, but wait, it doesn't look quite right. What's missing here? Another story, maybe? You don't know, so you call up your friend. This is the woman who taught you how to build. She's an architect with a good eye. She answers from the other side of the planet. Now she's standing in front of you. But more importantly, she's judging your building because she can see it right in front of her as well. She's maybe standing inside of it with you, or this is what it feels like. Looks like. The two of you inside of the building that doesn't yet exist. You take a walk through the project and kind of talk out the problems. This is your world. Your surgeon patches up your body with the assistance of the best doctors in the solar system. You keep up with your family in real time throughout the day, in person. You maybe even work right next to them from different corners of the city or world. You fix your computer, your habitat, your rocket ship with real-time assistance from the people who built it. And if you built it yourself, you're calling up consultants. Now, on top of that, games and art permeate every corner of the world you see. This affects a kind of rich, complex tapestry of color and sound and light, accessible at any volume and at any depth you like. But then maybe you want a break from the layered world, so it goes quiet. Or you take a trip to the other extreme, and you enter a new world altogether. Nighttime comes, and you slip into your VR gear. You walk into the metaverse with that friend of yours, the architect, and you battle dragons together with like giant swords and magic powers for the fate of mankind. And then maybe you fall in love. And maybe that's for real. And maybe that's what we should talk about next. From reproduction technologies and the future of fertility to relationships. Clutch those pearls, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we're talking sex in space. From Founders Fund, I'm Mike Solana, and you're listening to Anatomy of Next. New World.